Welcome to All Things Marine, Hawaii's thought-provoking show dedicated to marine science and ocean conservation. All Things Marine, brought to you by Kosi Island Earth and the University of Hawaii, Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. And now, here's your host, the marine science gal, Carly Weiner.
Aloha. I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal, and today we are on site in San Francisco at the International Ocean Film Festival. I'm super excited to be here previewing some of the amazing ocean films about marine science, recreation, and conservation. There are a plethora of events around the festival and lots happening. Today we will talk with several of the filmmakers showcasing films here this weekend, but first we will chat with the lady of the hour, Anna Blanco, the Film Festival Executive Director. Anna joined the Film Festival in 2011 and has more than 10 years of experience in executive nonprofit management. Welcome to the show, Anna.
Thank you.
We'll start with, what was the goal of the International Ocean Film Festival and how did it first start?
So our goal is to inspire people to care for and protect the ocean through independent film. Independent films have so many wonderful stories, and through storytelling, you can create action. We started at the Dolphin Club, which is one of the oldest rowing and swimming clubs here in San Francisco. And a group of people got together and said, you know, we need to use film to tell stories and to promote action. And they thought at the time there was a lot of interest in promoting it here in San Francisco with the Bay as our background.
So how long have you been involved for, and how did you first hear about the festival or get involved?
So I'm a sailor, and I take kids sailing on the bay here in San Francisco. It's mostly at-risk youth. A lot of kids who've never been on the bay. I've always lived on the Pacific coast, and I lived my high school years in Lima, Peru, so I was always eating fish and on the beach and enjoying the ocean, so and same here in San Francisco, and I've worked for several nonprofits, so that's kind of how I got involved.
So you whole life ocean, work and play, and I love that. That's fantastic. So, I mean, people are coming to enjoy the films, but may not get a sense of the work that goes behind organizing the film festival or the behind the scenes. So, you know, this doesn't happen overnight. How does it evolve, and what does it take from you to put together the film festival?
Well, that's a great question because a lot of people don't know what it takes to put a festival like this together. So our 4 days take place every March, but we start accepting films on July 1st. And so I have about 40 people volunteering. It's beginning in July 1st when we start taking films in. And it's a labor of love, obviously. We also have about 60 volunteers on site this weekend. So we started out as a volunteer organization. And quite frankly, we couldn't do it without them. And a lot of work goes into it. We have a student film competition. We start accepting those films in July. So we're pretty much consistently on it for at least 9 months.
Wow. So almost a full year of planning start to finish. And you must get so many films. How do you select what gets shown in the festival?
We get a lot of submissions. This year we had 144, and we're showcasing 48. Representing 12 countries, but we had 23 countries represented in the submission. So we look for films that really resonate with our audience. If they tell a story. Sometimes it's about conservation. Sometimes it's about marine wildlife. Coastal cultures is one of my favorite subjects, how people engage with the ocean. So much of the planet lives along the coastline, and so many people depend on the ocean for their economic viability. So. We look for films, quality, technology, current storyline, and current issue perhaps that's taking place in the world regarding the ocean. We're getting more narrative, which I think the audience is really excited about. And we get every genre. So we have feature, we have short, animation, mostly documentary, but everything under the sun, basically. So there's something for everyone, is what I like to say.
Well, even participating this morning in the student film portion, it was great to see the variety of subject matters and themes and humor versus, you know, serious. There's so much going on there. So tell us a little bit about the student portion of this, because it's not just the festival for the public.
So that's one of my favorite parts of the festival is there's two components to the education program. One is the free student education program. So we bring in about 1,200 Bay Area middle school and high school students, and they get to come for free because we have some sponsors and some grants. And they get to see films that are culled from the main program. And the filmmakers are on stage, like you saw this morning, and we bring scientists. And it's just a great opportunity for these kids to see something about the ocean that they might never have experienced. The other piece is the student film competition, which has gone international. It's in its sixth year. And we got 120 submissions this year, and we have four countries represented. In fact, there was a group of six kids that came in this morning. They're from Turkey, and they came just to see their film on the big stage. So we showcased 15 finalists on Sunday morning at 10 a.m. It's also free to attend. And then we give the students cash awards based on first, second, and third place in both high school and middle school. So super fun. And you would be surprised. These kids have a story to tell. And we don't ask them to put in a call to action to help protect the ocean, but every single film, the kids are telling us what needs to happen to help save the ocean and protect it. So they're the next generation of ocean conservationists, and they get it. And they're great at telling their stories. They're great with technology. So it's one of the most exciting parts of the whole film festival.
I was blown away by Dylan's film this morning, one of the students he submitted. I mean, if you didn't tell me this was a student film, I would have guessed this was a professional who had done that.
Dylan is 13 years old, and the film is called Plastic is Forever. It's 20 minutes long, and he did a great job in terms of telling a story about the origin of plastic, and he has some great historical footage. And I learned so much from it, and he is so talented, and he's actually even started his own nonprofit film group, film production company. So he's definitely someone we're going to hear from down the road.
Well, it's definitely that generation we need to reach out to. I'm interested, you know, given the current political climate and, you know, climate change being such a bad word in a sense, did you notice any themes or specific environmental commentary that came up more often than not in the film submissions this year?
There were a few on climate change, but I think the nice thing about the festival is that there's so much variety. And there's certain subject matters. There's one about turtles and, you know, how turtles are suffering because there's not enough places for them to lay their eggs anymore. There really isn't a common theme. It's just nice to offer so much variety, and I think that's what people like to see when they come to the festival.
And any crowd favorites or any new events that are happening this year that you haven't done in the past?
Well, this year we're excited to host four panel discussions. So it's an opportunity for people to come and learn more about what's happening in the ocean. And it may not necessarily be film related. So there's the one that is Women in the Ocean. We get a lot of young women who are marine scientists and biologists and oceanographers. And we have four very distinguished, accomplished career women who are going to tell them, you know, how they got started. So there's four panels, and obviously we have one on sharks. So it's nice to have an opportunity for everyone to come together and talk and have a community gathering to talk about the ocean.
Now, you have a bit of a background in educational entrepreneurship. Has that impacted how you approach some of these student opportunities or education pieces of the film festival?
It does. In fact, I started the student film competition because we knew that the kids wanted to have a say, and we wanted to encourage them not only to look at the opportunity to make a film, but also give them an idea of what it would be like to be a filmmaker, and also what it's like to raise money for your film and how to promote your film. And the funnest part is making sure they give credits in the film. Like, they want to download Beyoncé and use her song, and they're like, did you get permission, you know, from Beyoncé to use her song? So that's teaching them about the business side of filmmaking and not necessarily just the ocean aspect of it. So yes, that plays into it a lot.
Excellent. And I'm more surrounded sitting here right now with a bunch of the filmmakers that are here for the film festival. How many of the filmmakers actually come into the festival or participate in the events ongoing throughout the weekend?
So I think our count was 25 visiting filmmakers, but we have a total of 55 filmmakers and filmmakers' guests or representatives of films. We have, for example, I think here in the room, we have someone who worked with somebody on the film, and she happens to be in L.A., and she's coming up just to meet with the filmmaker because they never met, but they worked together. And we're getting a lot of people who are flying in from all over because they want to participate. They want to see the film. They were part of the film. And I think they want to get that camaraderie back that they had when they were making the film, which is such a fun part when you're working on a project so intimately for, in some cases, many years, to be able to regroup and just kind of do another big kumbaya. And that's what this festival is really all about.
Now, I know you said it takes about 9 months to put the festival together, but you also offer some educational and outreach opportunities throughout the year, not just the festival itself. How do you organize that, and what types of things do you offer?
So we have a traveling program where we take the films to other cities, and we just had one in Alpena, Michigan, which sounds odd because they're not on the ocean, but they love the ocean, and they want to protect it and learn about it as much as anybody else. We take the films overseas, so we've been to Spain and Hong Kong and Russia, and we just got an inquiry to go to Nova Scotia, and I think I just convinced the kids from Turkey to host one in Istanbul. So it's an opportunity to showcase the stories of the films yet even more, and that was something I started when I first came on board. I was so impressed with the films and really wanted to be able to help the filmmakers and say, this story needs to be told multiple times. So that's something that we do. This year we're starting a filmmaker in the classroom. So we just got a grant, and we're going to be able to take the film to the classrooms and have a local filmmaker come in and talk to the students, because not every kid can come to the festival. So it's a grant for us to be able to take the films and the filmmakers into the classroom. So we're really excited about that.
That is an amazing idea and a very cool program. I'm excited to see what comes out of that. So if people want to come to the film festival or learn more, you know, for next year, maybe people from Hawaii want to come fly in for the festival, where can they go to find more information?
The website is the best place, oceanfilmfest.org. It has our schedule. It has a list of filmmakers who are attending and everything about the student education and the student film competition. We'll be taking commissions for that starting July 1st. So it's a fun summer project for kids when they get out of school to start thinking about what they want their film to be.
And I thank you so much for taking some time out of your very busy week to talk to us about the film festival. We are very excited to see all the films that are going to be showcased.
I'm so excited you're here. Thank you so much for having us, and I hope everyone has a wonderful weekend. It's only day one, so there's lots to come. Thank you.
Thank you, Anna. And before we take a break, we're going to check in with some of the filmmakers. We're going to share some of the stories of the films that are going to be showcased this weekend. First with us is Claudia and Henrik Schmidt, producers of the film Little Sharks of Bali. Welcome to the show, guys.
Thank you for having us.
Hello, Hawaii.
We're very excited to have you on the show. So first, tell us, where did you travel from? Because you're visiting San Francisco, and tell us a little bit about the film Little Sharks of Bali.
Well, we came all the way from Germany to San Francisco. We arrived yesterday, so we are still a little bit jet-lagged. Our film, Little Teeth, is about a shark rescue center on Bali, and it's probably the only one of its kind. Bali Sharks is the name of the organization, and he came up with an agreement with local fishermen who were bycatching juvenile sharks mainly. And instead of killing them or selling them to aquariums, they keep them alive and give them to him for some money. He kind of pets them a bit and rehabilitates them, and then they will get released back into a marine protected area.
Well, I had the pleasure of doing the film today, and I have to say I was fascinated. I had no idea there was a program like that going on in Bali, and I think it's just fantastic. Idea of what he's doing. How did you first hear about this program or decide to do a film about what they're doing?
We travel to Indonesia a lot. Since many years, we've been going to Bali and Lombok, the neighboring islands. And through the people there, we just got into contact with Paul, who's running this organization. And we fell in love with his story immediately because he's just one guy. He's a surfer from Hawaii, actually. He lived there for a long time. And he's making such a difference on a local level. We love these sort of success stories, and we just had to get that out.
Well, it's nice to see someone from Hawaii out in the international community doing marine conservation. And in the film, it shows you actually getting in the water with some of the nursery sharks or the sharks that they're rehabilitating before they release them. What was that experience like?
Well, they're all small sharks. They're juvenile sharks. They're babies. So I wasn't really scared, but I'm actually not really scared of sharks anyway because the risk of getting bitten is really low. But still, I was excited because I didn't know how they would react to me. And then as a diver, I'm also taught to not touch anything. But then the sharks just started touching me. And that was really funny to feel them and swimming all around me. It was quite exciting. And they are so cute.
Well, I do think that is one of the important take-home messages from the film is that, you know, these sharks aren't targeting people and there's nothing to be scared of. I mean, they are reef sharks. We're not talking about, you know, tigers or great whites, not re-releasing those guys. But what other messages do you think are important in the film and what for you is a take-home message here?
I think one of the most important messages is that anyone can make a difference. Even if the challenges are high, like Indonesia, for example, is one of the largest exporters of shark fins. So having one guy there who saved more than 200 sharks just by himself with a small organization, that's an important message. And then also sharks, we don't have to fear sharks. Yeah? We have to learn to love them, to protect them better because they're in such peril.
Hendrik, what do you think are some of the reasons why people have this love-hate relationship with sharks, and how does that get addressed in the film?
Well, I think it all comes from the film Jaws in the end, right? It all started to people getting scared of sharks. And I think, well, they have teeth, and they're, like, down there. When you're swimming or surfing, you just can't see them. They're on the surface, so your mind and your fantasy is just making up a lot. But if you have enough courage and scuba equipment, just go down there and see for yourself. They actually are pretty shy and lovely animals. They're just beautiful.
Was there anything else that was surprising to you when you were filming or something that you learned after making this film that you didn't know before?
Well, good question. For me, it was really interesting, well, the technical part about getting the sharks over to the national park, because it's a 2-hour drive with the speedboat. So you have to enrich the water with air and be very careful because you can hurt them, actually, kill them while transporting them. But, if you have anything.
Yes, one thing that got observed first, apparently, is the bamboo shark that was changing its color. So when it was in the pens, it was all dark and just one color, actually. And when it was released back into the wild, into the ocean, it started showing its stripes. So Paul, the founder of Bali Sharks, got really excited about that. We didn't know that before, that they can actually color more.
Having that visual right in front of you must be very rewarding and also high stakes. Like, I can imagine being involved in that shark rescue and racing against time to get them 2 hours away to the marine preserve to get them in the water. What's that experience like? Is there adrenaline going on? Is there a lot of chaos? Or is it fairly calm? Or how does that feel to be involved in that?
Yeah, it's super exciting. We were in constant contact with Paul on Bali. We were 2 hours away on the Gili Islands, and every message was just pure adrenaline. The speedboat delayed, and we have to take care of the sharks, and then, now they're like 5 minutes away from the island, and we were getting ready with all the scuba gear and the filming equipment, and we had to be ready and right on time to release them.
And it was really exciting because you give the sharks a second chance. Actually, they were already caught, so actually there was already the moment they got killed, right? So, and Paul does make differences to buy them back and give them a second chance. So it was really like, well, it would be a bit much to say giving them a birth, but but it was definitely exciting to just give them a second chance to go out there and maybe get big and become a real shark.
And for me personally, it was really emotional to take that one shark out of its transport box and put it back into its ocean home, yeah.
Well, conserving the ocean is definitely the theme here this weekend, from San Francisco to Bali to Hawaii. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and when we come back, we're going to learn more about the films being showcased at the International Ocean Film Festival.
Quarterback looking, firing across the middle. Wow, what a grab in traffic. Larkin really had defenders hanging all over him, but somehow he comes up with the football.
On the football field, you've got to stay focused and not get distracted.
NFL Hall of Famer and President and CEO of CTIA, the Wireless Association, Steve Largent.
The same is true on the road. So before your wireless phone becomes a distraction, take a timeout for safety. Place your phone in easy reach before you leave. Never take notes or look up a phone number while you're driving. In bad weather or traffic, call later. Dial sensibly and use a hands-free device. You know, your wireless phone can be your best safety tool to call for help, stop a crime, or help someone in need. However you use it, remember, with wireless, safety is your call.
The wireless industry reminds you to drive safely. For more information, visit www.wirelesssafety.org.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, the Marine Science Gal. Today we are here in San Francisco at the International Ocean Film Festival learning about all things ocean. With us now, continuing our conversation, is Claudia and Hendrik Schmidt, producers of the film Little Sharks of Bali. So we were just talking about that moment of release when you participated in the shark rehabilitation and sending them to a marine protected area to go wild in the ocean. Was this an experience that you feel changed your perspective of the ocean, or how did that experience change or interpret the messages you put in the film?
Well, usually as a diver, you're told not to touch anything and just look with your eyes and leave nothing but footprints. So to get the chance to really physically touch a shark, and not only touch it, feel it, but also give it a second chance and release it into the ocean, that's been very emotional for me. But I've been emotional about the ocean before, so I cry, I have tears of joy when I see whale sharks or manta rays and stuff like that. So it didn't really change much, but it was a very rewarding feeling for me.
Excellent. And so what made you guys decide to submit the film to the Ocean Film Festival, and is this your first time here?
It's not the first time here. We've been here last year, and it was so much fun. We've been here with another film about building artificial reefs, also in Indonesia. And, well, we definitely decided we have to come back to San Francisco because the International Ocean Film Festival is just so much fun and such a good feeling here with all the people involved. So, well, we had to come back.
Well, I can definitely see that. It's a great community here. What's next for the film and for you guys professionally? Do you have new films on the horizon?
Well, the film is going to be screened at further festivals, like, for example, in South Africa, we're very excited about. And then we have this, a new film coming out about climate change and coral bleaching that we witnessed last year. And then in April, we are off to Indonesia again to finish filming our new documentary about manta rays and how citizen science can contribute to better conservation and protection of these amazing species and others as well.
It never stops. There's so many stories to tell.
Well, you definitely have to make it out to Hawaii, especially for that manta ray conservation, because we have a huge manta ray, or swimming with manta ray, issue over in Kona on the Big Island. So why do you think films are such a good medium for educating the public, and how are people being educated by the films that you produce?
Well, film is, everyone loves films, right? Well, I would say everyone loves films. you see it, you hear it, and then you start to feel it. So it's a good medium to bring really complicated issues to the people. Yeah, and it's always fun to watch if a film is well made. And I would also say, but I'm a filmmaker, it's more interesting than reading a book. Yeah.
Both have their place, definitely. So if people want to learn more or if they want to see the film, is there a place where they can go view the film?
Yeah, people just can, they could just go to our website, which is thejetlag.com. We're also on Facebook, on YouTube, on Instagram, on Vimeo. The films are online there for free, so people can just hook up with us on social media. The Jetlag, that's our name, and people will find us.
What a perfect name for a pair of traveling filmmakers. And last, is there anywhere people can go, or what can everyday people do to help better conserve our shark population?
Well, the most important thing is don't buy anything with shark products. Shark fin soup, you should never, ever eat that because it's so cruel and responsible for, well, close extinction for many sharks. But shark products are also hidden in facial creams or, just cosmetic. So keep an eye out for that, and that's the best way we can do. And don't fear them. They are not as dangerous as most people think. They need our protection.
Well, I can't wait to see what else you guys come up with. I was really impressed with the film today and look forward to seeing more. Thank you so much for taking some time to be here with us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Excellent. Now moving from sharks to fishermen, we are sitting down with another pair of filmmakers from the festival. We have Leo and James here with us today, who produced the film The Last Fisherman. James lives in the UK and is a trustee of the Cornish charity called Kona, working with disadvantaged youth and in a mentoring role. And co-producer Leo is also here with us today to talk about the film. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us.
Hello.
So first, let's talk about the film, The Last Fisherman. What is the basic premise of the film?
So the film, The Last Fisherman, is the story of Malcolm Baker. He is the last traditional fisherman in the Rain Peninsula of Cornwall. And he is the last of his kind. And the world around him has really changed and left him a little bit out of sorts. His industry has completely changed. His community, which was based on his work, is now based on another thing of tourism and not fishing. And the world around him has left him a man out of time. And it's about how he connects with an Austrian youth worker, Leo. And it's about their friendship that leads to young people getting back involved in Malcolm's, it's his passion, but it's also his profession as well.
So, Leo, you are showcased in the film and you helped produce the film. How did you first initiate this relationship with Malcolm the fisherman?
I was working in the same village for a European program, sitting in the office, and one day I just went down, or was called to go down to the beach, and I saw Malcolm. And then a relationship developed, and I changed my office job to become his apprentice, kind of.
Excellent. And so did that relationship happen naturally? Did it click right away, or did it kind of take time to evolve into more of a close relationship?
I think it was first a clash of cultures. First of all, I come from Austria, from the mountainous area, and for me, living by the sea was not that common or not that easy. On the other hand, I was using technologies. I was traveling around the world. And Malcolm, he's living in a very different style, a different speed, in a very different understanding of the world. So I think it was quite a hard, but very, very inspiring, beautiful way to come to a friendship like that.
Excellent. And so where does the film take place, and how long ago was this film?
So the part of the UK is Cornwall, and it's in the Rain Peninsula of Cornwall, which is actually quite close to the city of Plymouth. And it's a really beautiful spot, very kind of untouched. The village looks like it should have looked 100 years ago. It's like it's out of time. And it's it's probably one of my favorite places in the UK. I mean, not just because of the people down there who are very welcoming, very friendly, but also it's just really is stunning. It takes your breath away when you look at some of the views and you see some of the sights down there. I mean, I think Leo, yourself, you've really fallen in love with the place, haven't you? I mean, how do you feel about the location?
I think it's a very beautiful place, a very calm place, and kind of a place where time stops still. They say in Cornwall that watch goes slower. And I think this space and this way of living just inspires everyone who goes down there.
Do you think that slower sense of time is from an absence of technology or a simpler way of life? Or why do you think it's a little bit slower?
I think it's respecting the nature and it's enjoying life. It's nothing to do with the technology. They have everything like everyone else.
So what first intrigued you to do this film about Malcolm Baker? Or how did that spark come to be?
I'm blaming the guy sat next to me. I met Leo in Manchester on another project, and he arrived late, and he arrived dressed like a Cornish fisherman, and he sat across from me and spent the next hour while we were eating to tell me about Malcolm Baker and this amazing village and this story that he really wanted to tell. And after a short while of saying no, I eventually said yes to go down and meet Malcolm. And very slowly, gradually over the space of maybe a year or two, we got to know him really well with the camera, and then we were in a position to start making the film.
I think that's so important, building up that trust, you know, not just going in there with a camera and interviewing dead on, because it does take some time to warm up and develop that relationship.
Oh, for sure. I mean, as Leo alluded to, Malcolm's very closed. He can be very grumpy, and he can get angry, and being able to put a camera into his environment and his world, it did take a lot of negotiating, a lot of patience, and it was really born from Leo's relationship and Leo's love and passion for fishing. He shares that with Malcolm, so Leo was really the way in. Without him, we wouldn't have had a film.
So, Leo, what do you think are some of the take-home messages or lasting impressions that the film leaves the audience with?
Take it slower, enjoy the life, and see what's out there. How beautiful every single centimeter of a place can be.
And do you feel that you have more of an intimate relationship with the ocean after working out there with Malcolm and producing this film?
For me, I think, as I said, it's a very new environment, and I have been enjoying for 7 years such incredible moments, such beautiful hours from the middle of the night going out to the sea during the day and seeing species I would never thought are existing, that I just think I can bring back a lot of stories and experience to my family and to my people.
That's incredible. So, James, I mean, a lot of people aren't familiar with documentary filmmaking, and it's not a matter of just picking a topic and picking up a camera and then it's done. What kind of goes into that process, and how long does it take?
Well, I mean, this film's taken us probably 4 years in its planning and making, so quite a long time. I mean, I actually moved my life from living in the north of the UK to move down to Cornwall for 2 years to complete it. So it was quite a large commitment, but I say commitment, and I make it sound like it was a sacrifice. I loved every minute of it. It was a pleasure to be involved and to be welcomed into that community. So from our point of view, we worked out which angles of the story we felt were very important and did our best to explore those. But with documentaries, things don't always go to plan. So we have to do our best with sometimes what we're given. And I think that's what we did. We were able to explore Leo and Malcolm's relationship, which I felt was crucial. And then I could develop the story on my own, but then I brought a larger crew in to help film the more complex bits like fishing at sea and aerial photography and things like that.
Yeah, what kind of considerations do you have to take when working in a remote area and out on the ocean?
Yeah, I mean, it's very dangerous. In the UK, it's considered to be one of the most dangerous jobs you can do. And you hear many fishermen telling stories of getting their legs caught in a rope, especially if you're crab fishing, because you have a pot that's attached to a rope, which then goes into the ocean. And then if you get your leg caught as they're being shot from the boat, yeah, you can get dragged down under, and there's no way to really get back from that. So you've got to be very careful. And it took a lot of time to build that trust with Malcolm to be able to go out and make sure he felt that we were safe. being able to operate on the boat without him, without getting in his way or without him thinking, oh, we're in danger. So that took a lot of trust. I mean, also, weather was a big factor. I mean, when you're shooting, if it decides it wants to rain, then you've got nothing you can do. Like Leo was saying, you accept that situation. And when the weather's bad and you're out at sea, the only thing you can do is either take a seasickness tablet or be sick or get used to being on a boat that's rocking and rolling all over the ocean.
Luckily, usually that seasickness subsides after a couple of days for most people.
Yeah, I mean, for myself, the first few times you go out, it's a real assault on the senses. You've got the smells of the boat, the smells of the fish, and the being on the ocean. But with Malcolm's boat, it was fine. And we went out with Malcolm's son, who's a trawler. He's more commercial fisherman and fishes in a big way. And the entire day I was seasick. It was a horrible experience that I hope never to relive again.
The seasickness diet. So what are some of the interesting traditions with the crab fishing that you both, either one of you, have learned by participating in this culture and community?
One thing I enjoyed a lot is that the grabbing does sustain as a really sustainable way. It means the grabs you catch, you only keep the ones who are big enough and the other ones are returning back to the sea. Like we call it the grab hotel when we take out the pots. So this is one thing. One special thing I think about Malcolm in this case is that he's still able to do willow pots, which means pots are made out of willow as they have been made 100 or 115 years ago already.
Wow, I bet you the willow pots are absolutely beautiful. And would you say that, you know, traditional way of fishing and somewhat sustainable way of fishing, is that unique to Malcolm or is that unique to the area where all the fishermen in that region are sort of adhering to that?
Well, I mean, just to interrupt, Leo, yeah, I would say that that's quite unique to Malcolm in terms of in doing it to his standards. He's very much a professional. He's very passionate about what he does, and his skills have been passed down from people he knew in the village, and they're quite local to that area. They probably differ from people who maybe are in other parts of the UK. So certainly the way that he works with boats, definitely the way he works with pots, and his style of fishing is quite unique to Cornwall, and I think that makes it even more special to preserve those skills.
That's amazing. I mean, I can't wait to see the film. I haven't seen it yet, but I'm really excited to see some of the imagery and visuals that go with that.
But I think there's a very special side to this film because while Malcolm now is in his 70s and thinking or forced to retire maybe, we started together with him a scheme for young people who are unemployed. This means we bring over kids from all over Europe to redo boats with him, which are in the end of each project and donated to a good cause. And for this, I'm very much excited that his experience is used in a very positive way.
So, Nick, that this is finished, you've completed the film. What's next? Do you have any other films on the horizon?
Well, for myself, I'm quite passionate about Japanese culture. I practice a martial art called Aikido, and in Japan, one of the most difficult martial arts courses in the world is based around Aikido, and the next project hopefully will see us over there for a whole year to follow the adventures of this very difficult course that the Japanese riot police take, and foreigners can go to Japan and take the course, and we'd love to explore the experience that they have.
Wow, it's such a different contrast, but really interesting.
Yeah, very, very different. And that's the beauty of the job. I can explore lots of different areas of life that I would not normally be able to. So I'm very fortunate there.
Well, that's fantastic. And so what inspires you or who are some of your role models that allow you to explore such different and unique documentary topics?
Well, in terms of documentary filmmakers from the UK, there's a presenter called Louis Theroux who did some series here in the US called The Weird Weekends, and he explored subcultures, and I guess kind of that's what we did. I mean, there's a lot of peculiar things about sort of British life and British communities, and so it was nice to explore the small community aspect in our film. Also, in terms of travel, Michael Palin, he's one of my favorite presenters and documentary makers who really inspired me to go down this road.
for me, Last Fisherman, of course, will be a lifetime experience. I will continue in social work and teaching. I just wanted this film to be done to explain to my people, to my children, how Malcolm Baker and his life is. And I also wanted to make the film to protect or to share this experience with local people.
Amazing. It sounds like such a great story. I'm really excited for the film. If people want to learn more or see the film, is there somewhere online they can do that?
Absolutely, there is. The website is lastfisherman.eu, and we have a trailer on there and lots of information about how people can see it in the future.
Fantastic. Leo, James, thank you so much for taking some time. Looking forward to seeing the film. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, more about the films at the International Ocean Film Festival here in San Francisco.
You mean I could have diabetes and not even know it?
Then why would I want to know?
Heart disease, amputations, stroke, blindness can all be caused by diabetes. So it's critical that you know. If you're over 45, you don't exercise, and you're overweight, you're at risk. But a simple blood test can detect the problem, and with early treatment, you can prevent the devastating effects of diabetes. Call the American Diabetes Association at 1-800-DIABETES. Don't be blind to diabetes.
Mom?
Dad?
How long should I wait for you?
Mom?
If I'm at soccer practice,
what if something happens? Will you come get me?
There's no reason not to have a plan in case of a terrorist attack.
Mom, if you're not home,
should we go to the neighbor's house?
And some extremely good reasons why you should.
Can you tell me?
Everybody should have a plan. Take 5 minutes to talk about where you'll meet and how you'll get in touch with each other in an emergency. For other things you can do to be prepared, visit www.ready.gov. A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and the Ad Council.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, the Marine Science Gal. Today we are here in San Francisco at the International Ocean Film Festival learning about all things ocean. We have several filmmakers and documentarians here with us talking about their films, and I wanted to pose a question to everyone who's here with us today about the importance of these documentary films in educating people about the ocean and what you think is a good way of getting those films out there besides film festivals. You know, we have a short time, maybe 3-4 days with these film festivals, but how else do you promote the films or how do you get them out there?
Well, with all the media we have nowadays and the opportunities, I think anyone can just shoot a film about topics they're interested in and just get the message out through Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, whatever. There are so many ways nowadays, and you don't have to make a big production. If there are stories that are interesting and important to tell, people can just do that. I think that's a great way.
James, what about you?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, in terms of the way that we see that the Last Fisherman is that it preserves a moment in time. So it's nice that passed down to future generations, and it gets people interested in the sea or interested in the different traditions and skills that Malcolm has, then I think that's a great thing. And obviously sharing that via live events like these festivals is a great way for us to reconnect with people who've been involved in the process. And then on social media and democratization of media, I think is only a good thing.
And one of the things that strikes me is there's participation from all over the world. I mean, we have Austria and the UK and Germany and all kinds of places covered, Bali covered, in terms of where people are from and where the films are shot. Do you think there is value in bringing together people internationally to look at the issues of the ocean all around the world? I mean, there seem to be local but common issues between all of them.
I mean, the whole world is surrounded by the ocean, so we are all connected actually to each other, even though we're not seeing that every day. But, well, humans, we are still bound to the ocean. And if you, like, go out there and, like, watch the ocean, you're always stunned. And even if you see people who, like, have no connection to the ocean, just go there for the first time in their life, just like, boom, like, wow, I think I come from this place or something, they feel. So doing documentaries about the ocean is definitely an international thing and an international issue because it also produces a lot of air. We're all breathing that, and without that, we have a big problem. Yeah.
Anyone else have any other thoughts on that?
Yeah, from my perspective, I think the scientific community do that really well by sharing information, coming together and having conferences. It's just nice to continue that, but in a more artistic, creative sense as well, whereby the art can influence the science and also the science can have a real positive influence on the art form as well.
Excellent. And when you're at the festival, do you take note of the other films that are here, or do you pay attention to the other topics that are being covered? Is it inspirational for you for your next film?
For me, I, as other people have said today, I just love films. So if a story is engaging, then it's a really engaging story, and it's something I want to watch. Especially then if it's put together in a lovely package. So for me, I'm just excited to be in a cinema and to watch films, no matter the subject, really. But the ocean and fishing and these issues are something I'm also quite passionate about. So it's a nice balance.
Well, and nowadays, we have the internet. We're all watching films on the internet. But at the end of the day, films are made for the big screen. And there's, like, nothing better than having popcorn in the cinema. And, well, last year, we didn't... Well, we watched all the films, actually. We didn't miss one, and we tried to do the same this time, and it's definitely inspirational to see the work of, other people, other filmmakers.
And for the students that are at the film festival this year, what would you tell them if they're looking to have a career in filmmaking or looking for inspiration to make their own films? What advice would you provide them?
Well, get a camera, start shooting, yeah. Well, it doesn't depend on big equipment. It actually just take your cell phone, get a good story out and just film it. Start doing it with your friends, and then you will develop. In the end, the big camera will come at some point, and then some on the light, a lighting system, which will be big. But just start. It's just it's so much fun.
Wise words. Thank you so much. We're going to take a real quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk with one last filmmaker, Diogo, who's doing a documentary film called Adaptation Now. Stay with us.
Sometimes what you want most from your car is nothing. No headaches, no surprises, no anxiety when it's late at night and you're on some distant freeway in a thunderstorm. Owning a certified pre-owned Mercedes-Benz can be that anxiety-free experience on every level. You know you're in one of the safest and most thoughtfully engineered vehicles on the road. And with an unlimited mileage warranty, you can drive as far as you want for up to 3 years, with roadside assistance included. Your sense of confidence and adventure are as unlimited as the warranty itself. Now you can drive the car of your dreams and realize that nothing is everything. And during the Certified Pre-Owned Sales event going on now through February 28th, you can receive 2 years of complimentary prepaid maintenance and special financing available through Mercedes-Benz Financial Services. Only at your authorized Mercedes-Benz dealer. You've waited long enough.
See your authorized Mercedes-Benz dealer for complete details and limitations on Certified Pre-Owned Warranties.
On Saturday, March 11th, celebrate National Kidney Month and
take a walk on the wild side.
Get a free kidney health screening, diabetes testing, vision testing, high blood pressure checks, and many more free health-related screenings. Help prevent chronic kidney disease and take a walk on the wild side Saturday, March 11th from 11 to 5 p.m. in downtown Honolulu with the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii. For more info, search Kidney HI Walk on the Wild Side or log on to kidneyhi.org.
Welcome back. I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal, and we're here at the International Ocean Film Festival. With us now on the line, we have our last filmmaker to talk to you today about adaptation change. Welcome to the show.
Hi, glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
Great. I'm so glad you were able to call in. I know you just landed into San Francisco, so thanks so much for making some time. Where are you coming from, and can you tell us a little bit about the film?
Sure. I flew in from Boston today. I was actually filming the sequel to the film over the weekend, or parts of it. I was up in northern Vermont and Maine. The second film is going to look at what winter sports, how winter sports and winter recreation, the winter economy in those communities are being affected by warming weather and climate change in general. But the first film that we're talking about today is called Facing the Surge, and it's really about sea level rise. So what I do is kind of look at a very specific aspect of how climate change is impacting people today, predominantly in the U.S., so that it's very tangible and very immediate. And then at the same time, I focus on a particular aspect of the solution to climate change. In the first film, Facing the Surge, I really looked at carbon pricing and the work that's being done by a group called Citizens Climate Lobby.
Well, I am excited to see the film this weekend, and excited to hear that you're making a second film as well. What in the film do you think are the most important take-home messages that come across, and how do you think the film influences people to think about these messages?
Mm-hmm. So the most important one is that it's happening right now. This is not a long-term problem that we can keep delaying or not prioritizing and where we're allocating our attention to and our resources to. And that makes that case very plainly by looking at what's happening in Norfolk, Virginia, which is emblematic of what's going to happen across the entire coastline. So Norfolk's had about 16 inches of sea level rise since 1930, 8 of which are global warming, and the other half is subsidence. The land is sinking at the same time. So they become a very important case study in which we see what's going to happen to many of these communities. And they're literally having to raise their houses in the air 7 feet at a cost of $130,000 a house, and they have to raise the street. Then they have to prepare the infrastructure that gets impacted as well, water treatment plants. So all sorts of issues that people are having to deal and address today. So that's the first and most important message. The second one is, well, you know, this isn't going to get solved on its own, and there are things that people can do that are meaningful, much that go way beyond the changing of the light bulbs kind of message. And so it's putting in these role models of volunteers who are learning how to advocate constructively and productively and engage in a way that makes progress for their elected officials. I think that's the second important message of the film, and it's really putting the spotlight on those role models.
And how do you feel like the film empowers audiences to act in meaningful ways?
Very much in the way that it showcases what I would say should be people that they can really relate to and resonate. Like, you know, these are not celebrities or politicians that I'm putting as the voice of the solution. It's everyday people who are just finding the will and the time to work on this and learning how to do it and doing it collaboratively and together. And so I think it's through example that it does that primarily, and that was the goal. And then the second way has to do a lot with how we've worked on the distribution, where I spent all of the fall doing a tour from Maine to Florida. We did about 62 screenings in coastal towns, and we always use the film in those screenings really as not just the focal point, but kind of a tool that brought the community together and then connected them with a lot of the groups on the ground and some of the city planners and local scientists that were working on this. And so it became a way of connecting people with the groups that can keep them engaged on a long-term basis. Because my personal view is that a film is a very effective way of not only bringing people together, as I just said, but obviously piquing their interest and their knowledge around a certain topic. But 2 weeks later, most of us tend to move on. You know, the gravity of the day-to-day struggles we go through or decisions we have to make takes over. And so you really want to leverage the opportunity of when you're showing it to an audience for the first time to really make that connection when all the issues are top of mind. And we're very thoughtful about that when we use the film for screening.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for taking some time to call in today. We're really looking forward to seeing the film. And thank you to all of our filmmakers for sharing what inspires them. A special thanks to Anna, who organized the film festival. And please go online and learn more about the International Ocean Film Festival. I'm Carly Weiner. Now get out there and enjoy our ocean planet.